Black Sunrise.
And welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Ladies and gentlemen, our Kiwi collaborator for today is a man named Gordon Parlane. Welcome to the program, Gordon.
Thank you.
Now, you've been, sexually assaulted by a friend of the police on Waiheke in 1996, and the case is still, basically, it's still a little bit effed up. Could you let us know what happened? What was this incident?
I was on a private chartered fishing boat called the Doolittle. Nick Towns was the skipper, and it had five paying customers upon it, which I was one included. Upon that boat, 20 minutes into the fishing trip from Matetia Harbour, a person named Warwick Terence Cole of then 2 Onatangi Road, Onatangi, came up behind me and viciously, without my knowledge, slammed something on my rectum and my anus, right on the datum. And that item was a knife, which was encased in a fisherman's knife, encased in a wooden handle with a wooden sheath. When you put the knife into the handle, into the sheath, it just looked like a piece of wood, which he kept in his pocket. And immediately it happened, I felt the pain in my brain trying to escape out the top of my head.
Now, you also went to his place after this and a scuffle broke out, and the police were called to the scene. And what did they do?
Firstly, I went to the skipper's house on the Sunday evening, the day after the incident, explained to him what happened. I asked him for my money back. His wife thought I was getting angry, said she would call the police. I said I would remain there until they came. Then Mr. Towns gave me my money back, and I left. The next day, Monday, at 1:30, roughly, I went into the toilet of my girlfriend's house while she was at work to remove my bowels. I was sitting on the toilet trying to move my bowels. I was in great pain. I was looking at the verse of Desiderata in front of me on the toilet wall. The pain was so immense, brought tears to my eyes. And a vision of Warwick Terence Cole came into my mind.
And it seems that the incident is still fresh in your mind. And, this is not an isolated incident at all. You know, sexual assault does happen, and it really destroys people's lives. Please tell us more.
I went to Warwick Cole's house approximately 8 p.m. Monday evening. As I walked onto the property, two dogs walked out, came out barking. A man appeared on the balcony above in the dark and called out, "Who's there?" I replied, "It's Gordon Warwick. I've come to see you about an incident that occurred on the boat 2 days ago." And he quickly said, no, nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. I walked where he was and stood below him and clearly and calmly said to him, "Yes, it did happen, Warwick. I'm come here to see you about it." And he repeated again, no, and brushed it off. Nothing happened. Then I persisted with my claim that he had sexually assaulted me. And after a couple of minutes, he kind of went a bit limp and went, "Oh, yeah, it might have happened. Sorry." And on that admission, I went to the left of the balcony, see if there were stairs up there. There was none. I went to the right. There was none. So I went back, stood below him, sighted the pole below him, and hand over foot, I went up that pole. He watched me come up over the balcony. His head was right there. I then stood in front of him and said, "Now, why did you do it?" He immediately started to go into reverse. No, no, I didn't know nothing like that. You got the wrong address. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, the pain in my butt was not lying. And with respect to myself, I reached over and I gave him a slight thump on the left cheek. At that moment, he dropped his shoulder, took two steps back, roared like a hungry lion, and he careered into me, took me around my midriff, had me over the balcony. For 3.5 minutes, I was lying with bruises just the top of my hips where the balcony was, the balcony rail, and the rest of my upper body was hanging over the balcony with a drop about 25 feet below. This went on for 3.5 minutes, approximately, and Mr. Warwick's cold position was like a man on a woman. He was lying right across my body, my head hanging over the balcony, and his head right on my face. And I was quite repulsed. It took me another 3.5 minutes to work him off me, where I started to squirm my right thumb into his right eye, and I pushed it in about up to about a half before he relented and got his body off me, and then I laid into him, and he laid into me. We had a good fight. When I started to get the better of him, he then recoiled into a corner and started to cry, act like a coward, start crying. His wife had to call the police. I said, well, that's good. I'm not going nowhere. I'm staying here till they come. After about 2.5 minutes, I started to notice that he was whispering to his wife, the tin, the gun. Get the gun. When I would not relent him and let him out of the corner of the balcony because he wanted to go inside, I was afraid for the gun. He then charged me again. It was in the dark on the balcony. It was a long balcony. He charged me about 20 metres, took me with his weight right through four chairs, two tables, right to the end of the balcony. He was trying to get me over the balcony again. We ended up on the ground. He had my head. We were both on our fours. He had my, he had me grasped by the head and the hair. I had him grasped with one hand on the head and one hand under the chin. He tried to slip my thumb into his mouth and bite, where I pulled my hand away. I realized I had a free hand. I pushed his head into the balcony floor. He screamed. He turned around and went to dive into the house. He had moved up unbeknown to him from the ranch slider, and he crashed into the two bottom panes of the French doors leading to his child's window. He then immediately pulled himself out of that, squirmed across the balcony deck, and I last seen him crawling fervently over the threshold of the ranch slider into the house. I feared for the gun. I immediately dropped over the balcony and ran to the cover of the hedge in case he shot me. He then screamed out, come back, Gordy, come back and fight me now. And I screamed out to him, you tell the police. And he said, no, you tell the police, Gordy. And I then went home and I heard a knock on the door, 8 o'clock the next morning, Tuesday morning.
And it was the police at your door, wasn't it? Now, this man, Mr. Cole, he was indeed friends with these police officers. He's one of their fishing buddies, was he?
Very much so. On the fact he had gone out on this boat previously the week before with Michael Wardlaw, who was also on the boat. Michael Wardlaw was also on the boat when I went out. And Warwick Cole is a friend of Constable Alfred Blair, badge number F329, and it is well known.
Okay, now they took you in to the police station and they sat you down. They decided to try and take you seriously, but then they changed their tune all of a sudden. What happened there?
He asked me at my girlfriend's house about, he came to see me about an incident at Cole's house the evening before. I said, yes, that's correct. I was there. I said, but it all started 2 days ago on a boat. He jotted down in his notebook and subsequently signed it, okay, on the boat, I'll get that in writing. Will you accompany me to the police station to make a statement? I clearly state, yes, I would. And it's noted in this police notebook and signed by him. I went to the police station with him. We were 10 pages into a recording of what, a writing of what happened. And then he asked me, when did you assault him? Well, firstly, when I was telling him what occurred to me on the boat, he was acting repulsively and saying, ooh, I don't like that. But, well, that's the facts. That's what happened. He then asked me, when did you assault him? Before I could reply, I noticed that he was writing in, I assaulted him. I then pulled him up and said, excuse me, you asked me a question. Before I have formulated my answer, you have already written down it. He got very aggressive, said, are you trying to tell me something I've never heard? I said, no, you simply asked me a question. Before I formulated an answer, you have written down yours. I want to talk to my lawyer. I terminate the statement. He asked me to rip the paper out and have it, and we can start again. I said, no. He then screwed the paper up and asked me to take it. I said I would not, because he would say then that I did it. He then abandoned the statement was terminated in mid-sentence. He then took me into room to ring a lawyer. He then stood over me and said, if you weren't sitting on that chair, I would damn well knock you effing off it. I rang my lawyer since then. Shortly after that, he just said, well, you know, the police say nothing. Give me your name and address and that's it. Mr. Alfred Blair, Constable F329, escorted me outside of the police station to the cell blocks. He said because I did not go through with the statement, he was going to charge me with a more serious charge. As we accompanied the two-man cell block, he opened up the grill to the cell. I stepped forward to go in, and his comment caught my attention. He said, just off the record. As I said, it caught my attention. I turned my head. He put his face right into mine in an intimidating manner, and with a cheesy grin, asked me if he had had a big rajah and was his penis out. I said, that's a very serious comment. Do you mind repeating that in front of my lawyer? Which he replied, yes, you do. And a few lawyers later, maybe another one more, I still endeavor to have this case looked at.
Now, you've had difficulties, in fact, getting the court case itself even heard. You've told me that you've been going to court numerous times, and sometimes the police don't even show up.
On my first appearance in the court for a defendant hearing on the 30th of January, if my memory is correct, I attended the court in the Auckland District Court, and the police did not appear. And the lawyer of that time asked for it to be removed from the court and was denied. And as was on two other occasions, and as on was the last occasion, the police did not appear in court. Yet on the 6th of December, 97, when I came over from Waikiki Island on the ferry to go to the court, I noticed Alf Blair walking down Queen Street towards the ferry, and it struck me as odd. When I appeared in court, I was informed that there was no police representative in the court. The lawyer presented to the judge that the case should be chucked out. The judge refused. And then the lawyer in question said that if I did not do anything smart and plead guilty, he would walk out on the case. And he made me give a voluntary plea of guilty, which on appeal, he wrote in an affidavit to the judge that requested that affidavit from him. This was my 11th appearance in court over a period of 11 months.
Now, you've also experienced some arrests after this incident in case, and it kind of accounts to police harassment. One case in particular was when you were arrested for, doing nothing really. Some witness supposedly said that you'd broken into a car, which happened to be your own car, while you were getting your kids some Subway outside of Auckland Hospital. What happened there?
Well, firstly, before that, 4 years after the date I was sexually assaulted on Waikiki Island on the boat called the Doolittle on the 2nd of November 1996, 4 years later to the very day after I had moved off Waikiki Island, purchased two houses, I was arrested again. And my son, 12-year-old son, was removed from me to a safe place on a prostitute's word. And he was taken to a safe place, apparently, where he was molested by a paedophile ring in the town I will not yet disclose. But I know the police did not inform the community of the paedophiles in that area.
Absolutely horrific story. And it was, in fact, one of my listeners who's currently living in China, I believe, who sent me the details of his dad and that kind of thing. And I had him come round here, and he travels with a decent pile of documents with him that I had a chance to peruse through. And, man, it's one of the most horrible things. And on this show, we do try to make light of terrible situations, but there's some that I'm not sure if I can, and I believe it would be disrespectful to do so, this being one of them. It's indicative of a wider problem, of course, and this is by no means isolated case, as virtually none of the guests that we have on here who've had terrible things happen to them are isolated cases either. You know, I mean, they're all unique, but they're all basically, six sheets to the wind, whatever that means. It's, I think that it's the job of the media to give a voice to the voiceless. If you don't do that, you're not a member of the media. All right, that's it, because you've abdicated your responsibilities. You shouldn't receive any benefits from it. And, I'd apologize for the listeners. I probably should have warned you about the graphic nature of our guest today, but it's just sometimes you really need to hear. Anyway, regardless of whether or not you want to, so that you can understand what people go through, and you can understand the enemy of humanity and all that entails, what they do and how to stop them. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will.
I was toting my pack along the dusty
Winnemucca Road. 3 years after that, I was then coming back to the hospital incident. My daughter complained of a hip ailment. I took her to our doctor. He made arrangements for me to go to the hospital to see a specialist with her. The arrangements were made and in place. I did take her to the hospital. Specialist did see her. They admitted her. At 6 o'clock, I waited there all day from 9 a.m. to 6. And then after she was admitted, I returned home to get her toiletries, pajamas. And when I arrived back, she stated that she was a little bit stiff and hungry. So herself, we obtained crutches from the nurses, explained to them that I was just taking her over to the Subway to buy a Subway for her with my son, younger son. We walked out of the hospital. We went to the Subway, which is right across the road. I brought them what they required. We sat in the bus shelter opposite the hospital by the pedestrian crossing. And while my children were finishing their meal, I walked around a side street where our car was parked 5 metres up the road, to retrieve a box of matches. I'm walking back from the car to the bus stop. I noticed a lady across the road, crossed diagonally right in front of me, staring at me. And it was something that I could not figure out until later. I returned to the bus stop. Children had finished their meal. This was about 8:30 in the evening. We'd been out of the hospital 5 minutes. I was escorting my daughter on crutches. She had one arm, her right arm and my left arm, crutches, two crutches in her hands. I had her handbag and she was leaning on me and my son was beside us. As I walked across the pedestrian crossing, a police car pulled up, stationary at the pedestrian crossing. Once my family and I touched the pavement, the passenger policeman jumped out. He was a Chinese man. Jumped out, went into a squat position, pointed his finger at me as if like a gun, and yelled out, "Stop, you're under arrest. You have been seen to have done a crime in the vicinity recently." My children and I were immediately stunned, shocked, and just could not believe it. There were over 50 people outside the hospital of various ages and descriptions and gender, and some in hospital gowns, smoking, taking it all in. And the second policeman driving the car parked his car on the footpath and got out. And from there, he was adamant that I had done a crime. To no avail, my family and I tried to put the truth across what our time had become of leaving the hospital. He became very abusive towards me. When he asked me my details, where do I live, he'd mutter under his breath, "Nowhere in particular. Do I have any children?" Obviously not. And I was trying to correct him to say, "You are putting incorrect details into the notebook. I would like you to correct that." He then read out my Bill of Rights, then paused mid-sentence and stopped. I made him read out the Bill of Rights again. That would be a correct. I informed him emphatically he was falsely arresting me. I had not done a crime. And I requested his number off his badge. And when I said that, he immediately put me under arrest for requesting his number off his badge, and yet it's there for the public to view and for the public to obtain. He handcuffed me behind my back, placed me in the back of the police car, and then went to check the scene of the crime. He returned 15 minutes later. I could tell by his body language that there was a difference in his air. As he was walking up to the police station, I called out through the window, "You had better be letting me out of here." He reached across me to undo the seatbelt. I was still handcuffed. I said, "There was no window broken, was there?" He did not reply. I repeated it. "There was no window broken, was there?" No reply. I gritably spoke into his ear, "There was no window broken, was there?" And he grittedly replied back, "No, there isn't." And he released me from that point. I've had a long association with a lawyer over this case for over 2 to 3 years. And when I requested the policeman's notebook, he did send in the notebook. I believe the details are inaccurate. And he also made a statement. And I believe that was wrong, because he only asked, requested his notebook, and he made a statement and basically gave his word first, his version of events. And as before, I've noticed of the police, they tend to play a vantage first.
Now, the current status of the case, I mean, you've been trying to get hearings for this, you've been in and out of the High Court, and, you know, what's currently happening?
As of September last year, I came into contact with the police again. They gave me a fine for not paying my diesel tax, road user taxes. And then on conversation, the policeman asked me when was the last time I had been in court, to which I started to think a very long time ago, I said. He said, "September 01, I said, "Yes, I think you are right. I think it was September 01. He related to me that there was an outstanding warrant going back over 8 years and that I should immediately get myself to the court and sort it out. It took me a few weeks to sort it out as the file was in the archives. Turned out it was at the Henderson Police District Court where the sentence was to have occurred. I went there, spoke to a lawyer. I produced papers from 8 years ago, showed him the papers. He exclaimed that it was wrong, that they could not have sentenced me to what they did, and that it was incorrect, and that he did understand what I was trying to say to him. And on my second appearance there, which I was wishing to fight it, the lawyer spoke with the corrections and they withdrew it. And that lawyer, I was able to show some papers that I've had relating to the previous incidents, as I have mentioned. And after showing him facts, categorical facts, he is of the mind that there has been an injustice done to me and my family.
In terms of the level of injustice that was in fact done to you, I mean, what kind of police are culpable here? How did they cover this up at all?
Yes, they did. And I'd clearly like to state at this opportunity that the reason why this case has lingered for so long is that there has been and is an obstruction of justice on behalf of the police. Upon making the statement in Waiheke Island Police Station, after the policeman locked me up, he then proceeded to go back into the interview room where he completed the statement in his own hand, came to 11 pages, and he signed his name, Alfred Blair, Constable F329, stating that Gordon Parlane refused to sign. But Mr. Blair put his signature to it, and I believe he has incriminated himself by that, because he then subsequently wrote out a 2-page police summary of facts. It states, upon apprehension, Mr. Parlane gave no explanation whatsoever.
Well, that sounds very, very corrupt of him. And Alf has been well-known on the island, as Albie was pretty much the longest serving police officer, who'd been there for somewhat of 10 years. And now you're telling us that he's proceeded to help cover up a sexual assault case involving one of his good friends, and indeed wrote false statements in order to do so.
Well, it's very plain to see, because I have in possession an 11-page statement of Alfred Blair's signature on it. I also have the summary of facts statement made by him, stating that I gave no explanation whatsoever. When a statement is taken by the police like that, it becomes state evidence. It's not his to withdraw or hold from the courts. After the nonsense that occurred from him, I engaged a private investigator, a former superintendent of the Auckland CBD. I've had 2 reports from him. One report slams the police to the point where he states, whoever wrote out the summary of facts to the court and seriously misled the courts.
Okay. And what's next for you with this case? I mean, are you still in and out of court or what?
I am still progressing with my current lawyer. And I do hope that the light of day will see the truth.
All right. I'd like to thank you very much, Gordon, for coming on the show with us today. Do you have any final statements for us?
I do. Policemen seem to think they're above themselves to the point that when you exit the loo, they feel they don't stink. I'd like to say more, but I think that's quite apt. I'd like to thank Mr. Eastwood for the opportunity to say what I have, and I actually state categorically, I have the facts and evidence before me, and the only reason it has not got to the court because of obstruction from the police. I also have 15, 16 private and confidential papers received from New Zealand Police Headquarters under the Official Information Act at my request to the then and still is MP of Titirangi, David Cunliffe. These papers are very revealing and speak for themselves.
Thank you, Gordon, for sharing your story with us here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Yep. Some of the worst kind of things that you could ever conceive of. And a lot of people have actually gone through incidents like he has. And, it's very clear from how he portrays it. They're still very much with him. You know, these kind of things don't go away. And that's the real tragedy, is that it can happen once and it'll affect you for the rest of your life. That's what this kind of abuse really results in, is damaged human beings. And, there'd be a lot of people out there who think that, oh, that's horrible, that's disgusting, I don't want to hear about that. Well, you got to hear about it. If you refuse to talk about these things that you really are uncomfortable with, you're never going to be able to stop them, are you? You know? I mean, what about you, Will? I mean,
that's the whole thing, you know. That's the whole thing about, don't bring up certain topics with certain people. Stuff it, man. No, here we are. This isn't a dress rehearsal. If you've got an issue with someone or something, I mean, take it up with them. Really? I mean, this is why the police are perceived. Oh, yes, bad things happen, but, you know, the majority of what they do is good, and we just need to tolerate all the bad things. And that's how those opinions are formed, because people don't want to expose, don't want to think about the bad side of things.
Well, because the implications are quite vast, aren't they? You know, I mean, if this is happening in one small community, what's to say it's not happening on a grand scale? And I've talked to many, many people who have been victims of police corruption in New Zealand. And, my faith in the police has been absolutely shattered. Not that I had any to begin with, but I would.
That's the thing, Vinny. If you can see that corruption happens in a microcosm scale, then if you extrapolate that, you can probably see, oh, okay, the world is operates on a corrupt basis also. But you see, it's okay for the media to say, oh, there's a real estate scam going on here, or there's, you know, some lending scam there, or Nigerian scam here. So it's okay to look at these small minutiae and how corruption occurs on minute levels. But then for you to say that, oh, maybe the UN, maybe the US, maybe all our institutions here, global institutions, are corrupt and part of something bigger. Well, that's a grandiose conspiracy theory. You're anti-Semitic now. That's how they paint it, you see? You can't – people don't realize that this is the operating principles of the universe. People are going to conspire. People are going to consolidate power. People are going to cozy up to their powers and try and outdo you.
Yep. Sad but true. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in partnership by GorillaMedia.co.nz. And we'll be right back. Final segment coming up.